Good day and welcome to What's Happening MoCo, a podcast from your award-winning government television station, County Cable Montgomery. Now, here's your host, Derek Kenny.
Good day and welcome to What's Happening MoCo. Today we'll be answering the question, what is Juneteenth? What is Juneteenth? And to help us answer that question, today we have a resident of Montgomery County, Maryland, Mr. Ray Smith. He's a board member of the Sandy Springs Slave Museum. And he's going to talk to us a little bit, not only about the Sandy Springs Slave Museum, but also about his personal family history and how it factors in to Juneteenth. Ray Smith, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing fine. How are you, sir?
Thanks for having me. Oh, well, thanks for being here and thanks for sharing information about Juneteenth. It's a very important day in many ways, but not many people know exactly what Juneteenth is. And I believe that you have an interesting perspective on Juneteenth because inside of your family history, there's a bit more information about not only your family, but how Juneteenth came about. What can you tell us about Juneteenth and tell us a bit more about how it factors into your family in particular?
Well, the general story of Juneteenth is when the slaves in Texas and certain parts of Louisiana officially received the notice that they were free. The Emancipation Proclamation was passed by Lincoln earlier, but many of the slaves in Texas never received that information. Plus, there's this big story about the Emancipation Proclamation. The Emancipation Proclamation could never have been enforced without a victory by the Union Army. So Abraham Lincoln was basically rolling the dice for military strategy, for moral strategy, in helping to win the war. But the ultimate result was the Union had to win the war in order to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation. But Texas was the furthest
well,
west.
Let's go back just one moment. Now, what in principle does the Emancipation Proclamation do for people that aren't so familiar with that process and that document?
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation, to many people, are words on paper. It basically says that all slaves in areas of resistance, meaning the southern states that had seceded from the Union, would now be free. Now, that becomes problematic, like I said, because many of the southern states, when they seceded from the Union, felt that they were no longer a part of the United States. Abraham Lincoln felt that the southern states, in spite of their secession from the Union, were still a part of the United States. So to the southern states, Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation meant nothing to them, meant absolutely nothing. But so for Lincoln and for the Emancipation Proclamation to succeed, the North had to win the war. So once the North won the war, the 13th Amendment was activated, which officially and legally freed all slaves. Now, while all of this is going on, slaves in Texas had no idea of what was happening. They did not know. So the Juneteenth celebration and the Juneteenth event, which was June 19, 1865, marked the official day that the Union Army arrived en masse in Texas, in Galveston, Texas, and General Order Number 3 was read by General Gordon Granger, who was a Union officer. That order was read from the steps of this particular home right here, Ashton Villa. Now, another little misconception about Juneteenth. A lot of people think Gordon Granger read this from this particular site, and that was the only place. Well, after he read it from that site, they proceeded to Black churches. They proceeded to Black farms. Black plantation owners and farm owners read it. Sheriffs read it. So in other words, it was being spread throughout the areas of Texas and not just one official location. This is the symbolic area where it was read. Now, let me also say something about Juneteenth in relation to my family and integrate this in here before I get to this particular slide. My area of Texas where my family came from were the following counties. County called Navarro, Texas, Freestone, Texas, Limestone, Texas, and Robinson, Texas. Those are the counties where my family came from. This would be north of Houston. This would be about 200 miles north of Houston, 75 miles south of Dallas. So my father's family grew up, and my grandparents and my great-grandparents grew up in this particular part of Texas. Juneteenth to them was not just a celebration. In my household, we didn't celebrate the 4th of July. Now, when I was a young boy, I mean, I didn't know why. It wasn't a big deal. It just wasn't celebrated. The biggest holiday was Juneteenth in my family. So I lived in Dallas, Texas. I began going to a location and a place called Comanche Crossing. Comanche Crossing is an old name because of Comanche Indians. There were a number of them in Texas in the 1860s. But Comanche Crossing was near an area called Mejia, Texas. It's spelled M-E-X-I-A. And a lot of people, when they see it, pronounce it as Mexia, but it's pronounced Mejia. Mejia is in Limestone County. So after this general order, which you see right here on the screen, the general order was very brief. Once it was read, once it was shared with different slaves in different areas, the reaction was different in different places. The initial reaction by many of the people who were slaves was joy and jubilation. Some people were so excited, they begin to cry, they begin to shout, they begin to dance and have a lot of fun. Of course, it did not take long for the seriousness of this to set in, that when you got past all of the joy, the question started being asked was, what do we do next? Where do we go? How do we make it? Well, for many of these Black people, the first choice was to leave and reconnect with family members that they had been separated from. So as far as my family was concerned, in Limestone County, one of the things they did was they left that area, that general area, and they began to set up their own communities. Set up churches, set up schools for education. Many of the schools were in the churches. Set up organizations where they could kind of organize the community with leaders in the community. And these leaders in the community were not necessarily the people who had formal education. These were people who were just looked up to as leaders. And many of them were ministers in the church. Now, what you see on the screen right now is the basic general order number 3. As far as my family was concerned, go to the next slide, Derek. Okay. This is the general who read the order originally. This is Gordon Granger, the Union soldier who read General Order Number 3 in Galveston, Texas. Again, I want to reiterate that this order was not read in one location. It was read throughout Texas. Now, when we talk about slavery in Texas, we're not talking about the entire state. We only are talking about East Texas. Slavery in Texas was concentrated primarily in the eastern part of the state. So from the south, it went from the Gulf of Mexico, Houston, Galveston, and that area, up to just below Dallas, Texas.
Now, because this is an audio podcast as well, are you able to read just a small snippet of General Order 3? Is there are you able to read some of the verbiage associated with General Order 3, and then let's describe what this general looked like that read the order as well.
Okay. This is General Order Number 3, and I'm going to concentrate on the latter part of the section. It was very short. It says, the people are informed that in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former master and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them. This means that they will become, they will develop a relationship of employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect or gather at military posts, and that they are not to be supported in their idleness, either there or elsewhere. Now, I think it's important right here that those last two sentences. This is basically saying, all right, you may be free right now, but you stay put. Stay where you are. Don't go leaving where you are. Don't go, you know, rummaging around all of Texas. Stay where you are. You are not supposed to gather at any Union military sites. And you are not supposed to exhibit idleness, which is basically saying we don't want you standing around and not working. So right now you find a place to work. You establish an employer-employee relationship, maybe with your former slave owner. But this does not mean you are totally and completely free. There's a little underlying message there in General Order Number 3. Now, the reaction of the slaves, some of them did stay, but a lot of them ignored that part and just left. And they went to either find relatives or they moved in large numbers to the closest cities, towns, large towns. So a lot of them left the rural area of Texas and they moved to Houston. They moved to Austin. They moved to San Antonio. They moved to even smaller towns like Waco, Brownsville, Galveston, Texas. And what you had take place is a development of what was called urban slavery, domestic slavery, where a lot of these people left the farms and they started moving to cities. Now, there are a lot of other stories about blacks leaving and going west, going out and becoming what we know today as cowboys.
Oh.
Yes, what was originally known as vaqueros. The Mexicans were called vaqueros. And many of these blacks went west and became cowboys.
Wow.
Many of these blacks became what we know today as buffalo soldiers.
Okay.
So that migration pattern from the deep south that went north that we're familiar with, where people followed the Mississippi River out of Alabama, Mississippi, and they went to Detroit, and they went to Chicago, and they went to Cleveland, and they went to Milwaukee. Many of the Texas slaves, migration pattern went west, northwest. So you had some former slaves that stayed in Texas. You had some that migrated to Oklahoma. That's a part of my family tree, too. Some migrated to Oklahoma because of the land, the free land before Oklahoma became a state. And that was Indian territory. Some migrated to Arkansas. And many migrated to California. And so in my family, the majority of my family, my father's family, born and raised in Texas, eventually migrated to California. So Juneteenth, in little places like Mahare, Comanche Crossing, which I was familiar with, became a homecoming. So in the 20s and the 30s, those people who, when Juneteenth celebrations were held, those people came back for homecoming. Many people actually didn't call it Juneteenth. They called it Homecoming. All right, now, if you could go back on one of those slides, let me make another connection. Go back one more. I'm the family genealogist, the next one after Gordon Granger. There you go. I'm the family genealogist for my family, and I have been fortunate to find history that is very, very interesting. These are the slave owners that owned many of my relatives in 1865 and before. This is Logan Stroud and his wife. So when General Order Number 3 was read, many of my relatives heard the news from the front porch. Go to the next slide there. This is the house. Many of my relatives got the news from the front porch of this home. This was the slave owner, Logan Stroud's home. He owned approximately 150 slaves in what is known as Limestone County, Texas. They got the information about being free from the front porch. Now, as the story goes, Logan Stroud was reading General Order Number 3, which is very short, as you can see. And the history says that he got emotional and he broke down and he started crying. And his daughter had to finish reading. And again, the reaction, see, one thing we have to be careful about when we just talk about these incidents in history, the reaction to Black people at that time were not always the same. There were some people who were saying, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? And there were some who could not wait to leave. So there was a myriad of reactions from Black people. But shortly after 1865, go to the next slide. Go to the next one. There we go. After 1865, many Black people in the state of Texas began to celebrate June the 19th as their Liberation Day. And they had many names for it. It was called Juneteenth. It was called Freedom Day. It was called Manumission Day. And it was called Emancipation Day. But Juneteenth is the name of that has basically caught on. Now, this little plaque you see right here, it might not be clear enough to read, relates to this. After 1865, there were many Blacks throughout Texas that began to look at Juneteenth as a celebratory day. Not so much a holiday, but a celebratory day. The early celebrations of Juneteenth were almost like going to church. The early celebrations of Juneteenth were very serious and very reverent, where you have Black people dressing up in their Sunday best. Yes, they may eventually enjoy themselves and have a good time, but there was a lot of prayer. There was a lot of appreciation for the opportunity for them to have what I would like to call possibilities. Now, as a youngster, I grew up listening to people who were in their 90s talk about Juneteenth. And I started doing the math the other night just to kind of give you a perspective. When I was in my early teens, 13 to 15, I was sitting and listening to family members who were in rural Texas talk about the importance of Juneteenth and what it meant to them. These were people who were in their late 90s. I had a cousin who was 100, and they used to talk about this. And when I did the math, I said, these people were born anywhere between 1865. They were born 1865, right at the end of the Civil War, to 1877. And in my family, there was these strange stories about Juneteenth. There were babies that they referred to as Juneteenth children. Now, again, this is not a general story that's talked about. And this may not be the same throughout Texas. But in my area where my family grew up, Limestone County, Comanche Crossing, Meharre, Texas, this is what people talked about. There were people who were Juneteenth babies, emancipation babies. Meant that they were either born right before they were freed or born right after they were freed. And these children were almost looked at, from what I remember from the story, were looked at as spiritual children. These were Juneteenth children. These were children who were born after freedom. So they were kind of anointed, officially or unofficially, depending on how you looked at it, they were anointed with freedom. You get me?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
you know, they were looked at as the special ones in the family who grew up post-slavery.
Now, when you showed an amazing story of Juneteenth. We've talked about where how it came about, and with the perspective of your family in Texas. However, here in Montgomery County, we have an institution that helps us to understand not only things that have significance in the African-American community and the greater American system or a community as a whole. We have the Sandy Springs Slave Museum, and of course, you're a board member. And their stories, like the one you shared, with a more local Montgomery County feel at the Sandy Springs Slave Museum. So why don't we talk a little bit now about the Sandy Springs Slave Museum and what people can find there, and not just any people, but what people, residents of Montgomery County, might find there that's significant to maybe their individual families, but also to our area, this part of Maryland.
Okay. I always say that the Sandy Springs Slave Museum is the best kept secret in Montgomery County, and that's not necessarily a positive thing to say. We are nestled in a community, called Sandy Spring, Maryland. We are right next door to Olney, Maryland. For those who are familiar with Montgomery County, we are right down the street from Sherwood High School. Another part of just where we are, we are located between New Hampshire Avenue on one end and Georgia Avenue on the other end. Back in 1988, Dr. Winston Anderson had this idea that he wanted to create a historical museum in Montgomery County, and he wanted it in Sandy Spring, Maryland. Sandy Spring, Maryland had this unique history and this unique relationship between Quakers that lived in Sandy Spring, and African-American slaves and former slaves that lived there. That's a whole nother history and a whole nother discussion. But the museum has been open since 88, and we have about three or four structures on the grounds. We have a permanent collection where people can come in and take tours. The museum is visitor-friendly because one thing that I like about it, as far as young people are concerned, you can touch things. You know, in many museums, you go in and it's like, please don't touch, you know. But you can touch things in the Sandy Spring Museum. Now, some of the pictures you see right in front of you right now, let's start with this log cabin here.
Okay.
This is an original log cabin that came from the farm of a man named Hollowell. And Hollowell was the first president of the University of Maryland. And I happen to live on Mr. Hollowell's property right now. I live in a community called Lake Hollowell. This is an original cabin. And when we have visitors to come, you can go into it. You can walk in. You can sit down on the bed. You can see the tininess of it. And you can hopefully get a feel of what it was like for people, 8, 10, or 12 people living in this cabin.
Now, let's talk about that cabin. So I was able to visit the Sandy Spring Slave Museum, and that cabin it was very small. It might be maybe, what, 10 feet by 10 feet, maybe size of maybe probably most people's closets or maybe a small bedroom. But right. Let's talk about
a little off. It had a little off, which we actually don't allow people to go up to because there may be some danger involved. But the idea is to get people when you walk in to understand how small, how tiny it is. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there could have been anywhere from 10 to 12 people living in this one room. And so you begin to hopefully you begin to walk away with a feel for what it was like growing up in this community in that time under conditions of slavery. Now, we have to be careful when we open the door, when we have little children, when we first open the door to the cabin, we have dummies that are sitting in there. And when children first go in, they are kind of surprised and shocked because they think that they are real people. But we're trying to make it as realistic for the tourists as we possibly can.
Now, I know I'm jumping around just a bit, but I'm a bit excited because, I visited the museum and I really appreciate a lot of what it offers. And we're looking at some of the external buildings. I think we talked about the cabin, which is on the outside of the building. But when you first walk into the museum, and I believe a staple of the African-American diaspora, I think you mentioned some of the first Juneteenth celebrations were more or less like worship services with people dressed up in their Sunday's finest. Let's talk about when you walk into the Sandy Spring Slave Museum, I guess on the bottom level, there's an actual church, a simulation of a church, not a real church, of course, but.
No, actually.
This church,
before the COVID pandemic hit, this little church was actually a working church. Services were held there on Sunday. It was non-denominational. Now, since the COVID pandemic, nothing has happened there. And so it has served in the past as a worship location and type of gathering place where historical information is shared to tourists. So when you come in the basement. And then you walk upstairs. And what I always hear from people when I give tours is, from the outside, the building looks very small. From the inside, because of all the different intricate rooms and the steps going upstairs, they are surprised at how large it is. And they are surprised at the number of artifacts that we have on to be looked at and to be touched and to be taught about.
Now, the staff there, from what I gather, and you can correct me and please share some insight on this, the volunteer staff, correct? Or so
a volunteer staff. And the joke I always tell is I had no idea what I was getting involved with when I started volunteering there, because it's a labor of love. We have the correct people in the right places to actually run this museum, because it's more than a notion. And what makes it also continue to run is many of the volunteer staffs are ancestors of the former slaves who lived in the area. So they take this museum to heart personal. It's not something that you just do as a sidebar. This is really a part of their personal history. And I'm just thinking, out of 8 or 12 people on board, only 2 are retired. Me and another young lady are retired. So these people have day jobs. Then they come to the museum and give of themselves to help make it work. And if it were not for these people and their volunteer work and their sacrifices, It wouldn't be a success.
Well, I will say one thing that we do on this podcast that I like to do. And when we see people that are exceptional, that are giving so much to the county, we like to give them a round of applause. So a round of applause to yourself and the rest of the volunteers at the Sandy Spring Slave Museum. And let's go back to the museum. It's really impressive. As you said, it's bigger on the inside than on the outside. It's kind of like Doctor Who. I don't know if you're talking about Doctor Who.
Say that, yeah.
But it's like it's different worlds. So we talked a little bit in the beginning. Right. We showed the pictures of the cabin on the outside. Well, there's also a picture. Let's go back to that slide. There's also a picture on the left that I believe describes what it's like in the bottom of a slave ship. Is that a picture?
On the grounds, this is outside the main building. Mm-hmm. On the grounds is like a quarter panel of a clipper ship, a transatlantic slave ship. And within that little quarter panel, there are windows where you could walk up to, and there are mannequins and dummies inside. And there's also a recording. Once you walk up to it, it's kind of remotely controlled. Once you get there, you can hit a button, and it will give you a little brief history of what slaves endured in the transatlantic slave trade. So that is, the kids get a big kick out of it. Adults get a big kick out of it, too, but kids get a big kick out of it. Now, on this slide to the right where you see the cabin, you see a little white building there. That building, when you go in that building is full of African art. So one of our charges at the museum is to make sure that we tell the story of the African diaspora. We're not just talking about Africa. We're not just talking about one place in Africa. Because slaves were taken from the continent of Africa and sent all over the world, literally all over the world. So the culture, the African culture, and there's not one culture in Africa, there are thousands of different cultures in Africa. Those cultures have been transmitted and have been sent all over the world, intermingled with other cultures, and created, and something uniquely different has been created all over the world, wherever we go. So if you're talking about the Caribbean, if you're talking about South America, if you're talking about the United States, if you're talking about Canada, if you're talking about the Middle East, no matter what you may be talking about, you're talking about the continent of Africa and the African diaspora. So we try to make sure that's a part of our story, that this African culture and history, positive and negative, transcends the world. It's all over the world. And I think we saw that kind of in the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. When we started, it was, you know, it was just this U.S. thing with George Floyd. And before you know it, there were people in England marching. There were people in Germany marching. There were people all over the continent marching, because we had that commonality. They began to realize that there was a commonality, no matter who we were and where we were. People of the African continent have this commonality and this history together. And we just need to kind of explore that a lot more.
And that's one thing I noticed about the Sandy Spring Slave Museum, because the name would imply that it's just a focus on slavery. But as we mentioned, I think in our brief conversation just now, it focuses on the African diaspora. It focuses on the Middle Passage with. And if you think that cabin, once you see that cabin where you had 10 to 12 people living, if you think that was small, and you look at the hull of that slave ship and the amount of people, and I think the mannequins help give you the sense of size, and it's tragic. It's interesting in a way, but it's also sad, as a sad reality. But it's something that, you know, you must see, and it's intriguing, and it's.
No, you have to, a lot of times it's hard for us to kind of realize it. But one of the things, I graduated from Tuskegee, and I had a few good professors. Matter of fact, I had quite a few professors. Mm-hmm. Good. They were very good. And there was this one professor that would always, no matter what came up, and some students would begin to say, oh, this is negative. We went through this. We suffered this trauma and this, that, and the other. And after people would finish venting, the professor would get up and say, here we are. Mm-hmm. We're still here.
Exactly. You
know, and yeah, in spite of all of those negatives, we're still here. We're still trying to reach back in our history as we reach forward in our future. And I think that's what the museum at the Sandy Slave, Sandy Spring Slave Museum
And you're right. And what I did notice was that you did have that beginning, the humble beginnings, of course, the slave trade and all that. And then you had the cabin. But you also have a room dedicated to what I want to say is eras of excellence, where you have contemporary African-Americans being honored. Michelle Obama, Barack Obama. You have artists being celebrated. You also have local Montgomery County icons that are honored there as well. So let's talk about that room and its significance as the entire package.
Well, that's the room that I had to get my learning from. There is a room that is basically dedicated to the people of the Sandy Spring area, and not just Sandy Spring. In and around that area of Sandy Spring, historically, were these little Black communities all up and down New Hampshire Avenue, all up and down Georgia Avenue, historically. And I'm not much of an expert on them, but they existed. And the museum is currently trying to pay homage to those families with the room at the museum dedicated to those people who were in that area, who made Black history in Sandy Spring, in Olney, in Rockville, in Brook Grove, in all of these communities. And the other thing, there's a couple of ladies on the board who do genealogy. And I'm always fascinated because when you talk about surnames, like you take a surname in Sandy Spring area like Snowden, which is a common surname. You have a white Snowden family. You have a Black Snowden family. You take all of these surnames and it goes back to a point in time where that white family at some point in history owned that Black family. And that Black family took on the surname of that white family. And those names still exist today in those communities. Many of those people, as children, went to Sherwood High School together. And there's a history that they even know about or may not know about that goes back to where one of the family members was a slave, one of the family members was a Quaker and a slave owner. So that history is there, and I'm still learning it. It's just absolutely fascinating to me that whole community is just full and ripe with history.
Yeah, and it's there, and it's there, and it's right for the for the taking, but for the visiting.
Let me remind everybody, as we look at this current slide, of where the Sandy Spring Slave Museum is located. On Brook Road, right off of Laytonsville Road, or some people refer to Laytonsville Road as Route 108. So you have the phone number and you have the email address. And we're on Facebook, and you can Google Sandy Spring Slave Museum to see the various events that are taking place.
And for the people that are just listening, the address of the Sandy Spring Slave Museum is 18524 Brook with an E Road, Sandy Spring, Maryland, 20860. That's 18524 Brook Road with an E, Sandy Spring, Maryland, 20860. And the phone number, if you have questions, 301-774-4066. And that email address that he spoke of course, is info@sandyspringslavemuseum.org. Yes, sir.
Yeah, let me interrupt you. I would be remiss if I did not pay homage to our leader, the person whose idea this whole Sandy Spring Slave Museum effort came from. It's Dr. Winston Anderson, who is from Jamaica. And Dr. Anderson is not really a historian. This is something that he just enjoys on the side, personally. Dr. Anderson is a retired professor, the former head of the biology department at Howard University.
Hey, you.
Won all kinds of awards, recognition. He's been given awards by President Obama. And the thing that just amazes me about Dr. Anderson is that in spite of his background being science, genetics, and things like that, he's also fashioned himself as a historian. And coming from Jamaica, he understands that there is that heritage and that link that is Jamaican and West Indian, and he's brought that to the museum, and he's trying to inculcate that in the community with people who come by and visit. So if you come by the museum, Dr. Anderson will be there. And so that's kind of like our living legend that's associated with the Sandy Springs State Museum.
And I think a little known fact, and it was shared with me when I visited there, and I've got a nice walkthrough, that he's quite the artist as well. Some of these, the models that we mentioned earlier, the model in the cabin, the models, I believe, in the middle passage, and also a beautiful tapestry, I think a wooden carving in one of the rooms was also fashioned by the good doctor, Dr. Winston Anderson. So he's wearing a lot of hats when it comes to this.
Yeah, he's a self-made man. And he also has done some of the stained glass in one of the buildings. Yeah. And he, I guess the best way to describe Dr. Anderson is a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
He would be two terms, a Renaissance man and an old term that comes from the 20s in African-American history, a race man.
Mm.
That's a term that you don't hear very much anymore. But a term called a race man would be a person who in everything they do, in everything that they approach, they do it from an African-American point of view. So he is a race man.
All right. And if you want the African-American point of view, or you want to get out and see the African-American experience, visit the Sandy Springs Slave Museum. If you can't do it now, do it on the 19th. It is back open. It is back to serve and educate. And speaking of education and serving, we are always here to answer your questions. We ask you to ask that question here on the show, What's Happening MoCo? We thank you and we appreciate you for watching this, for listening, and for always asking us questions. What's Happening MoCo? And that's it for this episode. As always, we ask that you subscribe to this podcast via Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon Music, any of your favorite podcasting platforms. Like us on Facebook, like us on YouTube, subscribe, and always ask the question, What's Happening MoCo? Because you deserve the answers. Thanks again, Ray, for being here, and thank you for sharing all of your great information.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, and please subscribe.